Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to our episode of Revenue Chat. Today, we have Bill Morgenstein, the crazy kid from Brooklyn, whose dream was to play baseball for the world-famous New York Yankees, which eventually didn't get past first base. As after a military tour in Korea, he got involved into building a multi-million dollar business. In all things, women's shoes. But it didn't stop there. The author of the popular book, The Crazy Life of a Kid from Brooklyn, which is full of humorous anecdotes and sales lessons, tells us that he owes his success to never prejudging a sale, and tells us a lot more about that next. Hi, everyone. This is Tony D'Urso with Revenue Chat, brought to you by Easy Sales Procedures. With us, we have Bill Morgenstein, highly successful businessman and author of the popular book on Amazon, The Crazy Life of a Kid from Brooklyn. As stated, Bill's childhood dream was to play baseball for the New York Yankees. He went on to get his bachelor's degree in business from the University of Alabama while playing baseball as often as time permitted. After his degree, he served a term in the military in Korea. Afterward, he began working for a shoe company and eventually became the president of the Kitty Kelly Shoe Company, running a chain of shoe stores while at the young age of 35. That's amazing. His new book is best summed up by a recent review from one of his readers, which I quote, "When I read his book, I was very touched. His writing is clear, entertaining, and funny. I learned so much more about that kid from Brooklyn. Couldn't put the book down. His crazy and beautiful life, his enthusiasm, and the willpower to keep going, even when anyone will feel that there is no way to keep going, is amazing." End quote. Bill is the president of the Marquesa Funding and Consulting Corp since 1970 and helps businesses get the funding they need starting at $1 million. Okay, get ready for some humorous and instructional anecdotes from Bill, including lessons in determination, success, and failure, all from the crazy kid from Brooklyn. And with greatest pleasure and honor, here is Bill Morgenstein. Hello, Bill. How are you?
I'm just fine. And it's certainly good to talk to you, Tony, and to everybody that's listening or will be listening. I think you'll enjoy this.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you so much for being on our show. I'm very pleased to have you. You've led a very industrious and successful life. You have a popular book out there. Now, of course, we all know by the title, The Crazy Life of a Kid from Brooklyn, that's where you were born. But I'm very curious as to how did growing up in Brooklyn, now how did that influence your writing, Bill?
It was influenced because of the life that I led at an early age with a friend who always got me in a lot of trouble, became really a best friend. But if there was any way he would get me in trouble, he did. We did things that if we did today, we would certainly be behind bars without question. And what saved me was when the police would chase us, we knew all the back alleys in the neighborhood, and they could never catch us. So we were lucky there.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we hope some of them aren't listening now because they'll probably wonder, who are those kids?
Well, they read the book, they'll find out about it.
There you go. The truth is revealed. Hey, Bill, when did you start writing? Your first writing?
I wrote a lot, used to write a lot of articles and business articles, answering blogs and things. And I did that for a number of years, and I was out. When I would be out with friends, and I have a very, very close friend that I used to tell some of the stories to, and one night they said, you know, Bill, these stories are just hysterical. You got to put it in writing. So I said, okay, sounds good to me. And 4 months later, the book came out.
Tell us about the book. What would somebody find in there? What kind of stories in terms of business, success, leadership, marketing? What would we learn?
There's a great variety. In fact, one of the things that shocked me about people talking about the book was there was a consensus that they had to read the book more than once. And I think the average was three times. And in fact, somebody once said to me, it was the funniest book they ever read. And when they said that, I read the book again myself to see if it was really that funny.
That is hilarious.
There's a lot in the book about business, about working for companies, sales lessons. And I think a lot of your audience is interested in sales. And of course, there's all kinds of sales techniques and sales lessons. And I make it very simple. To me, success in sales starts with a smile. Whenever you talk to anybody and you're face-to-face with them and in meetings, wherever, you're smiling. And I think that gets you past and opens a lot of doors. The other thing that I feel is important in sales is keeping your word. You don't lie to your potential customer. And something that is very important is knowing your product intimately. And I'm going to give an example of that. When I had my import-export company, which was in Europe and South America and also a little bit in Asia, I had an engineer that I had hired to oversee production. And the agreement that we had was that he would be overseas for 3 weeks and he would come back for a week because his wife wanted to see his face every once in a while. But he was the type that when he came back, he wouldn't stay at home. He'd come into the office and drive us a little bit crazy. And one day he said, "Bill, give me something to do." I said, "Okay. Grab yourself a bag and samples and go out and sell." He says, "Well, I'm not really a salesperson." He went out, spent 3 or 4 days on the road, came back, and he put in a pile of orders on my desk, slammed them on my desk, and he says, "See, I told you I wasn't a salesman." Now, why was he so successful? He was so successful because when he went to a person as an engineer and knowledgeable about production, they had confidence in him, and they wrote the orders. I think another aspect of sales is not to waste your time. If there is little chance of making the sale, and the recipient is not qualified, you stay away from it. If they are qualified and it looks like they really need the product and maybe subconsciously want the product, then you have to be persistent. So following those lessons, I think that's what's important. The other thing that was interesting is that I was mentored by some absolutely brilliant salespeople. And
any names we... Sure. I would love to hear some. Any names that we may know that of who you were mentored with, please?
I don't think so. These were people, for example, when I was going to the University of Alabama, I got a part-time job with a company called Alabama Fence Company. The fellow that owned it was a fellow by the name of Shockley. He was a real country boy. And picture the cowboy hat, heavy-set, jolly kind of fellow. And he says, I'm going to train you how to sell. We went out and said, come out in the road with me. And we got into his pickup truck with all the fencing material in the back of it. And he says, look, I'm going to drive along, and I want you to pick out a house. And at that house, I guarantee you, I'll sell them the fence. So I thought I was being cute. And I picked out a house that was a complete shack. I saw the door was open, and you could see all the way through the back. If we sold the fence would be more worth more than the house was. So I knew there's no way you're going to sell a fence. So we walk into the, and in those days you sold, you walked into houses and you sold door to door, not like today. So we knocked on the door, and a nice woman opens the door, and he takes a dramatic step backwards. And I look at him, trying to figure out what in the world he's doing. And we walk inside, and he takes off from the top of the hat, he takes it off, and he drops it on the floor. Again, I'm saying, you know, this guy's a little bit nuts. I don't know if I'm going to learn anything from him. And he sits there, and he doesn't say anything, and all of a sudden he starts to cry. And we both, the woman and myself, look at him, you know, what's wrong? He says, you know, I just had to get emotional because I see you have two kids playing in the back. And 2 weeks ago I called on somebody with a child, and they said they just couldn't afford the fence, and I didn't make the sale. And then the following week I read in the paper that the child was killed in by a car in front of their house.
Oh my.
So next, she bought the fence. And
oh,
he
my
goes
goodness.
Outside, and I said, why did you? I said, that's wonderful. I said, I don't know if I could start crying every time I walk into a customer. I said, but why did you step backwards? He says, because when you're talking to a woman, she's protective of her house. If you push forward, she's going to resist, and you won't get in the house. But if you step back, a woman is curious. And she'll follow you out, and that way you get into the house. I said, gee, that's amazing. I said, well, why did you drop your hat on the floor? He said, because every woman feels that she is a good housekeeper. Whether she is or not is something else, but that shows her psychologically that I believe she's a good housekeeper. So that was the lesson from Alabama Fence Company.
That's a good lesson for door-to-door sales. It's very interesting. I've done a lot of door-to-door sales over the years. That stepping back, that's brilliant. Though we don't wear hats anymore, not everybody, but that stepping back, I like that. That's a very interesting story.
Now, I had worked for Tomacan Shoe Company, and I got training I was trained by people like Peter Drucker and Frank Rooney, and they were tops, really tops to learn from. So, and then after I became president of Kitty Kelly, I joined a company as executive vice president of an import-export company. That was just before I formed my own company. And he says, okay, we're going to go out. And I knew some of the people he was selling to, and I knew a lot about his history. He says, we're going to New England to sell this company, Moore Shoe Company. I says, Eric, you really wanted to, we're going to drive all the way up to Boston to a company that you've had such bad luck with? Like almost everything that you've sold them either comes in late or is damaged, and it's a problem. I said, they'll never buy from you. He says, watch me. So we drive up to New England. And we go into the buyer's office. Buyer opens the door. He looks him right in the eye, and he says, you know what I would do if I was you? And the buyer says, what? He says, I would throw me out.
Oh, my goodness.
And the buyer laughed. We got in. We walked out with orders.
Clever. Clever. That was selling shoes. What were you selling?
We were selling shoes.
You were selling shoes. Shoes to shoe companies, shoe distributors.
Right.
Okay. Very clever. Brilliant. So go ahead.
No, all right. I can tell these stories all day long.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Bill.
Okay. When I graduated, college. I went to work for my wife's relatives because I knew I was going to be drafted in the Army. So I figured out, in fact, that's how I got into the shoe business. They were shoe wholesalers. And they gave me a route because the person was retiring after like 30 years working, and he was going to take me around. Now, this was in the hill country of Tennessee, where they were all hillbillies. And he said, I want to spend a few days with you before we ever call on a customer. He says, because we're the kind of people that if we have faith in somebody, we'll recommend them, and you can never let me down, which, of course, I had no intention of doing. So we spent some days together, and we got on very well, and he took me around, and we went around to the various customers in the area, and he had his arm around my shoulder when we walked in, so they had the confidence in me. This was back in the 50s. Some of the counties, like McMinn County, Tennessee, we drove through the entire county. There wasn't a paved road in the county. Many of the people were illiterate or semi-illiterate, and one of the things that I had to do was make the signs for them. You know, eggs, 39 cents a dozen, whatever it was. So that was one of my assignments when I went into. And one day I go into one of the stores, and the owner says, Bill, I wonder if you could do me a favor. I said, sure. He says, I have to go upstairs. His house was up on a hill. He says, I'll be back down in about 20 minutes. Mind the store for me. I said, okay. Customer comes in, and they had, and they bought, I don't know what they bought. They bought some groceries and went to the cash register to make change. And at that time, I had never seen so much money in my life, all in the cash drawer. So now I was in a panic. So when he comes down, I said, you know, you have all this money in the drawer. He says, well, you know, we don't use banks. We don't trust banks. And we keep everything in cash. If we have to send something, we'll send it to Western Union and things like that. I said, but how do you? I said, you left me alone with all this cash. He says, first of all, you've been pre-approved, so we know you. He says, second of all, if you did anything, which I know you wouldn't do, he said, you'd never get out of the county alive.
Oh, my. So, they know you well.
These were people. I mean, the people in the hill country were the absolute. First of all, they were honest to a fault. They were some of the nicest people that I had met anywhere. I still would like to go back to see how much that area has changed, because they were very, very unusual people. They were religious people. They were honest people. And I met some very famous people. Coincidentally, just before they died, one was Sergeant York, who you
what
may
was
or
he
not
like?
Have heard of.
Some of our audience may not, maybe before their time, I don't know. Tell us who is Sergeant York and tell us about him, please.
All right. Sergeant York was a great World War One hero. In fact, they made a movie about him, I guess in the 40s. Gary Cooper played him. I met Cordell Hull, who was Secretary of War in World War II, and I think a week after I met him, he passed away because he was getting on. But Sergeant York was given a home by the state of Tennessee, and he had a little store in it and sold a few. He sold dry goods and some shoes and groceries and things. It didn't buy much, but he was one of our customers.
That's awesome. It's nice to see that when someone's being taken care of like that. That's very cool. Very cool indeed. Who else have you met? Tell us more about any of these important people. I think you've mentioned some important people. You've told some stories about their book. Stories are told about them in your book. Tell us some of that.
Well, okay. I went to Carnival in Brazil. I think this was 1984, And it was an unbelievable experience. And if anybody travels to Brazil in that period of time, I certainly recommend that they go to the carnival, because it's a very unique and fun experience. And I knew a family, and the family invited me to go to the parades that they have in the stands. And they said, come around 6 o'clock. And I said, well, how long will this last? And I said, well, probably to about 10 o'clock. So I said, I'm not the one that really can sit for 4 hours in one place. I don't know if I can sit through it. They said, no, not 10 o'clock tonight, 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. I said, well, if you don't mind, I'll be back tomorrow.
Now that's a party.
Anyway, it was so entrancing. I sat through the whole thing until 10 o'clock the next morning without sleep. So we were going to meet up. I went back to the hotel. I took a shower, and we were going to meet up for lunch. And as I'm walking along, Regine, who was very famous at the time, was standing in front of a nightclub. And actually, I didn't know who she was at the time. But as I pass with this group, she looks at me and she pulls me aside like an old friend. She must have thought that she knew me. And I gather she might have been a little bit drunk, because I had no idea who she was. I found out later it was Regine. They sat us, and she ushered us in. There was a whole line trying to get into the place. I mean, but we bypassed the line. We sat down at a long table with some of the people that were in the carnival. Some of these girls with these big hats and the feathers and everything. And we sit down next to a fellow, and I start talking. I said, "Well, what do you do?" He says, "I used to play soccer. It was Pelé." And we got friendly. He invited me to. We sat in a couple of days later in a Formula One in a special booth. I had never been to a car race before in my life. That was quite an experience. So
nice.
I've met a lot of different people. The things that I wanted to do, I always wanted to meet a president of a country. And this was one of my ideal situations. And I came close a couple of times once. We were starting to develop Argentina as a country. This is when I worked for this Eric. He sent me to Argentina, and we were going to start exporting shoes from there to the United States. So first thing we had to do was hire an agent to run the office. And I interviewed this fellow, and I was impressed by him. And he said, "Well, we work a certain way in Argentina." He says, "You have to work through the military." And it was a military government. It was a rough government at that time. I mean, really rough. He says,
"We're talking what time period now? In the 50s?"
This was in the 80s.
Oh, okay.
He says, "I have on my staff a general and an admiral. And you'll meet them tomorrow, and we'll go out. We'll meet the Minister of Finance. We'll meet the Minister of Agriculture. We'll meet different ministers and see if we can get something started." So I come in the next day, and these two fellows come in. Now, what he didn't know was that when I was in 8th Army headquarters in Korea, one of my jobs was a protocol where we had visiting people from other countries, some of the officers, and I had to learn the ranks of the different armies. And I saw right away these were not even officers; these were enlisted men. And I called him aside. I said, you know what? You're not going to be our agent. He says, why? I says, because you didn't tell the truth. I says, these are not officers. These are non-commissioned officers. They're probably the rank of sergeant first class, the equivalent of a sergeant first class, or boatswain's mate. And he said, well, he said, if I told you that, and if you, he said, she just wouldn't understand it. But I can tell you this, and I promise you this, that a non-commissioned officer in Argentina has got more power than the officers. Was the officers live? They're just in it for the glory of it. They don't get anything done, but the non-commissioned officers do. So I took him at his word, and we went out. And we met these different ministers, and we met the minister. And the only one I was impressed with was the Minister of Agriculture. And the Minister of Agriculture was talking about the local politics, and his office was right next door to the president's. I said, you know, and the president, I think, was a man by the name of Vitello. He was an army general, so I said, you know, I would love to, I would love to, since you're next door, and you go into his office all the time, I'd love to meet the president. He says, when are you coming back to Argentina? I says, well, probably 3 or 4 months. He says, I'm going to introduce you to a real president because Perón is coming back.
Oh, good. Wow.
So I said, well, that's 3 months from now. I says, what makes you think that in 3 months, if Perón comes back, you'll still have a job? He says, I'm the only one that's secure. Because I own, our family owns a tremendous amount of land, and we've been dedicated. We're dedicated. We're not corrupt, and they'll never get rid of me. I said, okay, leave. We come when I do come back in 3 months at the airport. I said, you know, first thing I want to do, I want to go meet Perón. I talked to my agent. He says, we're not meeting anybody because the Minister of Agriculture was the first guy he fired when he came back.
Wow. Can never be too sure. That's funny. Wow. Yeah, with the new regime, you never know who's going to be in and who's going to be out.
Right.
But in the Central American and South American countries, From what I've heard, some presidents and high-ranking politicians are easy to find by going to the best restaurant in the area. I know a friend who was at a TGIF, of all places, in Nicaragua. And at that time, I don't know if it still is now, but at that time, it was the best restaurant in Nicaragua. So he's there having fun, and there's a table next to him with a large entourage, and eventually my friend, you know, they're drinking and he buys them drinks or they buy him drinks or whatever. And so he gets invited over to their table, and now he's drinking with the president of Nicaragua. Just very interesting for that part of the world.
Sure.
So I can see that.
Well,
I can see
on
that.
My first trip to Argentina, I went with a fellow from Brazil, one of the manufacturers, to buy leather. And we go into this town called Córdoba, which is always was a town with a lot of unrest, and it's a student town. And there were police all over. You couldn't go a kilometer or three quarters of a mile without being stopped by a bunch of kids with rifles. That you'd lower the window and they'd stick it in your nose and ask for your papers. I mean, it was not, Argentina was not a fun place then. So we went to the tannery and then we're spending the night in the hotel in Córdoba. And it was very late. And I'm the type of person I just can't go right to sleep. I usually like to walk around outside, but I was already warned, you don't go outside in the street at night. So there was in the room, there was a balcony, and you open up these two big, long windows, and I open it up, and there's a guy standing there with a machine gun.
So on your balcony?
On my balcony. I assumed he was there to protect me, but whatever it was, it really scared me, and I go back to I go back to the phone, and my friend was in the next room. I call him up, and I say, "Nestor, I just opened up the windows to my room, and there's a guy with a machine gun out there." So he says, "Look, Bill, do yourself a favor. Get into bed, pull the covers over your head. I'll see you for breakfast in the morning." Okay, so I do that. You know, what am I going to do? And 5 minutes later...
Sweet dreams.
Not even 5 minutes later, the phone rings. It's Nestor. He said, "Bill, I just opened up my windows. There is a guy with a machine gun out there." I said, "Nestor, do yourself a favor. Get into the bed, pull the covers over your head. We'll have breakfast in the morning."
There you
Which
go.
Which we did, and we got out of town right away.
Good idea. Wow. Yeah. Sleep well with that, huh?
Right.
Oh, that's priceless. So you've been all over the world.
I've been all over the world. I guess altogether probably 46, 47 countries.
Wow.
Seen a lot
better
of
it's better than I've done. I've done just one. No, I'm just joking.
Yeah, a lot of interesting things. And one of the things you find that people are, yes, they have different customs and things like that, but people are not so different anywhere that you go. You know, they most of them have families. They want to take care of their families. They'd like to prosper. In some cases, they like to eat and find a place to put their head down, put the covers over their head. And those that don't have that, it's, you know, it's a sad, that's a sad part of the world. But most people are really decent, and you get along. Not in every case. I mean, there are some places I went that weren't particularly friendly, but most places were. And you just find that you can get along with most people. Again, I think the smile is important.
I find that to be very true. While I have not done or performed or generated sales abroad, so to speak, when I do go to other countries, I find I always take a study of what are their customs and mannerisms, making sure that when I speak or hang out or deal with anyone that I don't offend. And I usually have the best time at any time I go out to any country just by following those basic rules of how do these people react? What do they expect? How do they work? What do they expect of you? You know, France is probably what I think one of the most famous cases in point where you hear generally French are rude. You hear that generally, the French are rude and that they have this attitude about the U.S. Well, I really beg to differ. It's the revert. It's really totally different. When I go to France, the first thing you have to do is you have to greet the person in front of you and let them know that you recognize them. It's like, so you say bonjour, you know, hello, good day, or bonsoir, good afternoon, good evening. I don't care how rushed they are. You just say bonsoir, bonjour, whatever. And it just changes their mannerisms instead of them thinking, oh, here's an American.
And you know what it is? It's not so much that it's France, as many people think. It's more big city, small city. A lot of big, very big cities, people are pretty much harried and they don't have a lot of time. But if something comes up where you need them, like in New York City, supposedly is a rude city, but if you need help in New York City, you're going to get it. If you need help in Paris, you're going to get it. Now, you go outside of Paris, it's a whole entirely different attitude altogether. They're, you know, the people are relaxed and in a different situation.
Yes, but I beg to differ in New York. When I was there, I went into, of course, you know, I was nearby Times Square, and I walked into some pizza joint. I don't remember the name, and I swear there must have been 30, 40 people. There was no line. I'm in California, Vegas, other places of the country. There's lines. It's orderly. Here, it was a friggin' mob. And so I stand there patiently, and people are ordering and I'm trying to like figure out how they're doing this and the guy's serving up and new people are walking in. They're next to me and they're getting their order in and getting their pizza and walking out. And I'm like, how do I do this? So I just start being loud and just raising my hands and everything. And before you know it, you know, I got the attention. It was so funny that you had to just, you have to learn the customs and just jump out there. If you do that in California, for example, people look at you like, what are you, crazy? But in New York, it's like, it's expected.
Right, that's right.
So you do have to learn.
Anyway,
how to
I have another, kind of a sales story.
Oh, please.
It's a story of or, you know, another business story. When I got out of the Army, went to work on the training program with Tom McCann Shoe Company. And there again, the first thing we did was go into some meetings with Peter Drucker. And I think everybody, most people on the call know who Peter Drucker was. I mean, he's the guru of management. I mean, if you read his book today, you're still going to get great lessons in management. And you learn a lot from him when he lectures.
Agreed.
He was quite an interesting guy. Anyway, after the training, you start on this training program. You start from the bottom. You start as a stock boy in the store, and then you become a salesperson. Then you become an assistant manager and a manager, and then you're a manager of some of the larger stores. So anyway, this was in. I was managing a store in Manhattan, and they said they're going to open up a men's shoe store on 48th Street in Broadway. And they expect big things out of it, and they want me to manage it. So, fine. We had the opening, and we broke a record for the opening. In 4 days, we sold 10,000 pair of men's shoes. And
that's
we were
incredible.
Able to do that. Well, I'll tell you what I did. They brought in managers from other stores to work the floors. It's a small store also at that time. It was the old Globe Theater. There was a little... There was a balcony in the back or a stage in the back. And what I told the salespeople, I said, look, when somebody comes in, you tell them to take any shoe because we have 50 stores in the area, in the New York area. You can exchange that. Instead of waiting a long time, take the shoe, take them back to your local store and get fitted for the right size, for the right shoe.
That's clever.
And that worked. I mean, that astounded management, the fact that we were able to sell that. Now after that big opening, it wasn't so easy because, you know, this is Broadway. People are not necessarily shopping for men's shoes when they come out of a Broadway show, and it's late at night. So, but you did sell a lot of hosiery. So I had to figure out a way to get people into that store to buy, at least buy hosiery if they didn't buy the shoes. And I had the fellow that I was stationed with in Korea, we were very close. He was an accordion player. So I said, still a friend of mine, by the way, he's still very close. I said, Jimmy, I need you to play the accordion in the store. He says, fine, be happy to. So now you had to go through channels. I had to call my district manager and tell him what I was doing. And he was a nervous kind of a guy. He said, Bill, let me check with the vice president to see if this is all right. And he comes back to me. He says, well, you know, you got rules in New York. He's got to have a union card. So I call up Jimmy. I said, Jimmy, are you in the union? He says, yeah, I'm in Petrillo's union. He says, sure. He says, I'm in the union. He says, that's not a problem. Okay, so, but my district manager was not giving me an answer. He was nervous and this and that. So I said, you know, I said, come on down and play the accordion. So he comes down, he's on the stage in the back, and we have the doors open, and people are coming, flooding in to hear what's going on. And again, we're not selling so many shoes, but we're selling a tremendous amount of hosiery, because I guess they felt guilty if they were in the store, they had to buy something. So now, who comes by but the executive vice president, a fellow by the name of Dave Herman, had a very, very tough reputation. I mean, he had a brutal reputation, and everybody was afraid of him. And my assistant manager was up front. He saw him, and he almost fainted dead away. He comes running back to me. He says, "Do you know who's in the front of the store looking in, watching all this?" I says, "No, who?" He says, "Dave Herman." I says, "So what? You know, well, what are we doing wrong? We're getting customers in." So Dave comes in, looks at me. He says, "How long has this been going on?" I says, "A couple of nights." He says, did you get authorization to do this?" I said, "Well, I wasn't going to blame anybody." I says, "No, not really. I pretty much did it on my own." I said, "I discussed it with management, but they didn't come back with an answer. But I felt we wanted sales." So he says, "Let me see the sales book before this accordion player came." Looks at it. He says, "Now let me see the sales book the last 2 days." He says, "This is incredible." He says, "Your business jumped like 5 times. He says, "You did a great job." Next day, I get a call from the vice president. He says, "Bill, I'm glad you put on the accordion player. You did a good job."
That's awesome. That's awesome because, yeah, in sales, when you really know you're going to get something and it's the right,
right.
thing, you sometimes just have to stick your neck out because, hey, it's just your neck.
Right. That's right.
That's great. That's awesome. I'm impressed at what you've done. I'm still can't get over the 10,000 shoe sales, 2 people walking
by. In
4 days. That's just mind-boggling, Bill.
And if you saw this, I mean, the store doesn't exist today, but if you saw the store at that time, it was hard to believe, because, again, there were 18 seats in the store. So you had to get them in and out right away. And that, you know, to me, that was the only way to do it. And it worked.
Just brilliant. Brilliant. What other gems do you have in this book? I love this.
there's a lot of them. I mean, there's the, to go back where we started, where I was kind of a rascal, and this, some of these things were accidental. I went to a school called Stuyvesant in Manhattan, and it was a scientific, one of 3 scientific schools in the city. You need to have to take a test to get into it, and somehow, not sure how I passed, but I did, got in. And I was, at that time, I had some interest in chemistry, which I never really pursued. And we had an assignment in chemistry class, what could be dangerous in the kitchen. So I knew the formulas, some of the formulas, and there is a couple of things you can mix that there is something called Noxon, which you can use to polish silverware. And Clorox, you know what Clorox is. Now, you mix them together and releases hydrogen and oxygen, and they separate, and you get a little bit of an explosion. It turns out that, and I said this, I didn't do it, but I brought the Noxon and the Clorox to class, but I didn't think I was going to mix them, except the chemistry teacher was laughing. He says, "That's nonsense." He says, that's not going to work." So I mixed them and almost blew up the chemistry lab.
Oh, no.
Of course, today, if that happened, you know, here again, you'd be behind bars. There they didn't quite do that.
Be sued by every student and every family of every student and teacher in the school. Oh, boy. You were the rascal.
And then when I was at school, one day, one of my friends was not, which incidentally, selling, everybody is selling. And because people will come to you and say, I'm not a salesman, I don't like sales. But you sell all your life. If you go in for a bank loan, you're selling. If you negotiate with a contractor, you're selling. You're buying a house, you're selling. You're, almost everything, if you think about it, that you do, if you do any negotiating at all, it's or interacting with people, you're selling. So I try to tell him that, because he was a shy kind of a guy. And I had a friend that invented a silver polish. He called it no-zip, something like that. And he said, I'd like you to go out and market it. So I said, okay, we go out, and here again we go. We're going door to door, and we knock on this door, and woman answers. I says, do you happen to have any sterling silver? She says, oh, yes, yes, and I have some. I said, do you think they need polishing? She says, yeah. As a matter of fact, I was about to do that. And I said, okay, we have something that's going to clean it for you. Well, she pulls out the silverware, and we're rubbing and rubbing and rubbing, and nothing's happening. It's not working.
You're rubbing the silver off.
So I asked her, when I said to the woman, do you happen to have Noxon? She says, yes, I do. I says, okay, let's try that. So we tried a Noxon. So we polished her silver with Noxon. So I guess she felt sorry for us. She ended up buying 6 bottles of the of our liquid.
Nice.
So my friend says, that's selling. I says, yeah. I mean, you know, that we're friendly. We didn't we did our best. So sometimes you sell by sympathy. that works.
Sure, I've seen a lot of that. Not so much these days, but back then, yes.
At times. Well, first of all, today the world is such that nobody listens. If you call somebody. And we see this every day. And you explain things to them, and you tell them things, and then they'll ask the same question that you just told them, and then you tell them again, and then they ask that question again. My wife just had a situation where she was ordering some medicines to, and we were in New Jersey at the time where we stay and spend our summers, and she called the pharmacy and she says, we're going back to Florida, ship it to Florida. So the person on the phone says, where do you want me to ship it? She says, I want you to ship it to Florida at this address. He says, is your zip code 07410? She says, no, that's New Jersey. You're shipping it to Florida, 33467. Hangs up. The other day,
let me guess.
Calls. He said, you know what? Medicine came to New Jersey. So that's what you're up against today.
True. It's true. It's I call it a highlight world where people just highlight things when they read. They don't really read to get it. Because if you really read a material and you understand it, you don't need to highlight it because you have it. But that's a whole other thing. I've run into that in my studies in universities and stuff. Like, why is everybody highlighting all the time? I just read the material and I've got it. But anyways, it's all for ease and convenience. And yes, and now you get people to some degree just don't seem to listen so much. Bill, what would you say are the most important sales lessons in your book or that we haven't gone over, if there's anything else?
Well, I don't know. I think pretty much what I said, because it's pretty, you know, it's pretty simple. You've got you have to be. I think honesty is very important. And I mean, there are times I've told people, "Don't buy this. Don't buy the product. It's not for you." And that gives them a lot of confidence. And maybe they don't buy it, but they may buy something else. And they'll say, you know, what else do you have? What else do you do?
That's a good way to make a loyal customer. I've used that before. It's a very good way.
Right. Yeah.
Because it's because sometimes the product isn't for everybody.
I don't think you can fake that. I mean, if people are usually astute enough, they may not listen, but I think they're astute enough to know when somebody is a phony. So if they feel that you're fooling them, you're not legitimate, or you're just trying to push something on them, that's going to have the opposite effect, and then you're not going to make any sales.
Good, Bill.
Anything else you would like? I always say what the disadvantages are, and what and then here again, if I really think that somebody can do better somewhere else, I don't know how many times I've told people, you know what, go here. This is better than what I'm offering you, and they're usually astounded by that. But again, at worst, you make a friend.
That's true. A friend that will come back if he needs your services. Anything else you would like the audience to know about sales, marketing, or leadership?
Well, leadership is something that's that comes with, I think, with all these ingredients. Being positive, and I'm sure you go to any sales course, they're going to tell you pretty much the same things: to be persistent, to be friendly, to be helpful. Being helpful is also important. To be dedicated to your job, to your company, to what you do, of course, to your family. These are all important ingredients. I mean, they're not. There's no mystery in selling and management, I don't think. Some of the books I've read try to make it mysterious, but it's I don't think it is.
Sort of like you're talking about, it's the basics that get one through to get a good sale. It's the basics. No matter what, there's always fundamental principles that, when utilized, help get a sale or help make the sale happen.
Right, exactly.
Well, that's excellent. Yeah. Excellent.
And I invite
Go ahead.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was going to ask, have you written any other books, or is there any other books in the work?
I have some ideas to write books. I want to write a book on economics and business, and I want to write a book on politics. Whether I'll get to do that or not, my wife isn't too thrilled over the idea. If it takes away, takes up time and things, but I do have. The advantage I have is I have a lot of references and old notes, and I keep articles that go way, way back in time, and I do a lot of research and a lot of reading. So I may still do that. But
it takes time. I agree.
I need more people to buy this book so I can go on to the next one.
Okay. Well, we're just going to tell everybody to buy this book.
I mean, if they do, if they have read it, to at least review it somewhere.
Okay, we'll tell the audience that in a moment. How long did it take you to write the book, "The Crazy Life of a Kid from Brooklyn"? By the way, the website is thecrazylifeofakidfrombrooklyn.com. So everybody, check it out: thecrazylifeofakidfrombrooklyn.com. Okay, Bill. Yeah, go ahead, Bill. So how long did it take you to write this book?
It took less than 4 months to write it. Because here again, I had old address books, old notes, a lot of old articles, and the only thing that I'm sorry about in the book is that I didn't put a lot of the pictures in, and I should have done that. I think that would have really made it even more exciting. as a book.
Well, you know what you can do on a website, if you do have pictures, put them on the website and direct people there.
I've done that, yeah. If you go to the website, you'll see some of those pictures. Yes, no question about it. There are pictures on the website.
And by the way, on this display console, some people, if you log in now or later when it's podcast, there are some of the pictures on this podcast that display through. Some of your newspaper articles and things like that I have displaying through on this.
Yeah.
Well, good.
I didn't put a lot of the newspaper articles in because there's a lot of, the technical economics, and maybe I should add, or I might add them to it because there's just so many of them. I just have to pick out the ones that are probably the most relevant.
Totally. Well, I think the world can always use another good sales book or marketing book from someone, especially who's been so well traveled, and you've been in such a wide, diverse variety of industries, and you've sold so much. Your sales that you've been involved with is just amazing.
Yeah. So, everything from door to door to selling wholesale and retail and involved with manufacturing and even some styling. Although some of the stylists I work with, were really well known. I lost a good friend about almost 6 months ago, Vince Camuto. Who someone you call may know. He was I think he was one of the greatest, and we used to work. I mean, I had bought from him. We worked together in one company, and then we were kind of competitors. But I could never hold anywhere near a candle to his talent. He had just tremendous talent. Again, I thank everybody for listening to me. I hope it wasn't boring.
No, not at all. We loved your stories, and we're just almost up in just another short little bit again. So that's The Crazy Life of a Kid from Brooklyn. I have with us Bill Morgenstein, who's been through it all. Been there. You're one person you can say, been there, done that. So thank you very much, Bill. It's been an honor and a pleasure to have you on the show.
I thank you, and I thank everybody again on the call. I appreciate you listening to me.
Absolutely. I hope to have you back sometime. It was great.
Okay.
Again, everyone, Bill's website is thecrazylifeofakidfrombrooklyn.com. He's been there, done that. Thank you again, and stay tuned to our next show on Revenue Chat. We are going to have Mark Hertering, author of Hanging Out for a Living. Mark says by giving service unselfishly to others, that you get referrals and volume. Now, you may think that sounds good, or maybe not even possible. Well, it's not only possible, but Mark has been doing it for 10 years. And we're going to learn all about that on the next episode of Revenue Chat. This is Tony D'Urso, brought to you by Easy Sales Procedures. Get the book at TonyDURSO.com. And if you want to read the first 30 pages of Easy Sales Procedures, send an email to support@TonyDURSO.com. Until next time, and remember, you can make life better for yourself and everyone. Choose wisely. Hi, this is Tony D'Urso, author of the new book, Easy Sales Procedures. You know, in my career, I've made impressive record-breaking sales forays into real estate, collectibles, insurance technology, and other varied industries.
My accomplishments include raising $3.25 million in a six-month period. Now, despite what we've been told, sales is an art. There are sales procedures that can be applied precisely as a science, but in essence, it's truly an art. There are fundamentals that you need in place that will help you with your sales, marketing, and business. Get easy sales procedures to help put your business into proper perspective. You know, too many people seem to make sales complicated. Hey, it's easy. All you need are some basics in three words: open, agree, and get. That's it. That's EasySalesProcedures.com. This book will endow you with the simple truths at the core of being a sales master, and also contains salesman training drills that, when practiced, demonstrate how to interest any person in anything. These simple procedures can be applied by anyone from any walk of life, because in modern day society, every person is involved in interesting or selling someone something. That's Easy Sales Procedures. Get your copies now at a low price from EasySalesProcedures.com. Order enough for all your employees too. Here's to volume sales success for your life and business.